Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. It's a Thursday throwdown wherever you are. We hope you're doing fun. Kind of a day for me, the producer, Mark Mancini, here in Los Angeles. I lost my dad 38 years ago today. God rest his soul up there in heaven, 51 years old. So, Dad, this show is for you. It is a Doc Talk podcast coming out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, hosted by a friend, a mentor, and a brother to me, Dr. Greg Roscoe, 347-205-9631. 60 minutes goes by quicker than Dan Rather doing that. So if you happen to miss it, blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So more of him, less of me, as I lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic. Doc the Threes, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And, boy, you're bringing another legend through your great show each and every week, and I'm so blessed to produce this. Take it away. I'll see you at the top of the hour, my friend.
Mark, thank you very much. And, you know, you're absolutely right. We've got an outstanding guest this evening, and people can get a hold of me, djrmd308@outlook.com. Things are going well. We're very fortunate, letting our audience know, Mark, that we've been having great guests, and the docs that we have on have been outstanding, and they're really willing to talk to our audience. The guest this evening and the topic this evening, some of the guests may not have heard about it. And what we're talking about is the big topic is skull base surgery, and doctors that do this are skull-based surgeons. And, you know, there's a variety of growths and tumors in the head and in the sinus that require very specially trained surgeons. And, you know, what kind of brought this topic up? I did get an email a couple of weeks ago about a gal from Philadelphia, by the way, that had a tumor in the pituitary gland, and she was referred to an ear, nose, and throat doctor that does skull-based surgery. She also had a neurosurgeon as part of her surgical team, and that kind of started me thinking, and fortunately, I had the acquaintance of Dr. Garrett Chobe. He's an outstanding surgeon in his field. Garrett, where were you born and raised?
I am a Pittsburgh native, Dr. Roscoe, so thanks for having me on. And I recently moved back to the Pittsburgh area, but it is the area that I was born and raised.
Wonderful. You know, I know, and I'd like my audience to know, he did give me a copy of his CV or curriculum vitae. It's about 40 pages. I wasn't able to get through all of it, but very, very impressive. You know, Garrett did go to school at Grove City, all kind of accolades, all kind of degrees, all kind of honors, went to medical school at Penn State, again, did extremely well. He then went to the University of Pittsburgh, where he did his otolaryngology residency, and by the way, that's where I did mine. And then he went on to Stanford to do a year fellowship in skull-based surgery. He was on the staff at the Mayo Clinic, at University of Pittsburgh, multiple campuses. The list goes on and on. The number of articles that he has written, the chapters in books have been outstanding. And we're just so lucky to have someone this knowledgeable on our show. So, Dr. Chobe, thank you again for spending the hour with us. And, you know, what I'd like to do, Garrett, let's talk about, you know, the specialty of skull-based surgery. What's it all about? Where did it start? Who were the founders of it? Can you help me with that?
Absolutely, and those are great questions to sort of lead off the show. First of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to speak with you and to visit with you today. It's really an honor to be on the show tonight. Interestingly, the field of skull-based surgery has been around, obviously, for a long period of time. But it really came into its own because this is a challenging area to treat tumors in growths that occur because a number of really critically important structures pass between the skull base and the areas you're going to go to, such as the nose, the sinuses, the eyes, and the lateral skull base, or where the ears are as well. So there's a number of things, including major arteries, so things like the carotid arteries, the basilar artery, which really give blood flow to the brain from the neck, as well as critically important nerves that provide things like sensation and eyesight and eye movement, all pass through those areas. So when tumors or growths occur in that area of the skull base, the junction of the brain and sinuses or the nose, they create really a unique set of challenges to address because we're working around these critically important structures. Because these tumors occur in these sort of, you know, very unique areas, it usually takes not just one surgeon, but multiple surgeons to address and attack these tumors. So most commonly in my world, I work with neurosurgeons. So the majority of surgeries that I do, I actually do as a team with another surgeon, most typically neurosurgeons, but also oculoplastic surgeons and head and neck surgeons as well, who have great expertise in working as a team to address and remove these tumors.
Wow. And, you know, Garrett, we talked about the word, if you don't mind helping us define a little bit, where is the skull base? You mentioned the base of the skull, the sinuses. You know, for our listeners, where is this? Where is this skull base? Can we put it in a little bit of a perspective?
Right. So it is kind of a challenging anatomic area to get a full grasp on. But for the purposes of today's conversation, we're going to define this as sort of a plate of bone that separates the brain for above and the sinuses or nasal cavity below. So if you think about your own head, sort of, you know, drawing a line just above the eye socket, kind of straight back, it's this area that separates, again, those important structures from the brain and the brainstem from the sinuses and the back of the nose, which we call the nasopharynx, or the sort of junction of the nose in the throat area.
And, Garrett, you know, who would be taking care of these? Before we had skull-based surgeons, what did this type of a patient do? Where did they go for care?
Right. So depending on where the tumor was arising from, a lot of these patients would go to see a neurosurgeon, and they still do. Things like pituitary tumors or meningiomas are most commonly referred to neurosurgeon, and that's typically where many patients start. And they begin their journey there, and then if they need surgery, then folks like myself will be involved as well. Other tumors would primarily see an otolaryngologist or an ear, nose, and throat and head and neck surgeon, especially for tumors that are arising in the sinuses or the nasal cavity. And those are most common things like sinonasal cancers or other benign tumors like inverting papillomas or other benign tumors, which would typically start by seeing an otolaryngologist or an ear, nose, and throat surgeon first.
Well, and, you know, Garrett, if we kind of talk about, say, patient care, you know, a patient would, you know, wake up one day, maybe have nasal bleeding or have a lot of pressure in their nose or sinus or start to lose the vision. You know, as far as, say, developing, what are the symptoms that this class of patient would be experiencing to go get care? What have you noticed, you know, what are the symptoms that you've noticed people come to you with?
Right. So it's an interesting question. It's a bit of a nuanced answer, but part of it really depends on where the tumor is arising from. So I'll give a couple examples to give the listeners kind of a taste of what we'd be talking about. Let's say a patient is having an issue with a pituitary tumor. Sometimes that can cause a problem by causing vision loss. Typically that would be lateral vision loss on either side of both eyes, because when that tumor grows upwards, it pushes on what's called the optic chiasm or the eye nerves, which vision is transmitted through. In other scenarios, if that tumor is a what we call a functional tumor, because the pituitary gland also releases certain hormones, they can cause problems by having an excess of a certain hormone, which causes a problem. The most classic example is something called acromegaly, which is a tumor that actually releases growth hormone. And many folks may remember someone out there named Andre the Giant. Andre the Giant had acromegaly. So he had overgrowth of his jaw and his hands and various other things. Now, his, of course, would be an extreme example, but more routine things, these folks who have an unknown cause for having maybe their ring on their finger, their wedding ring, has to be increased size every year, every other year, or their jaw has grown quite a bit. Those kind of things would be from release of excess growth hormone, which, again, is a pituitary tumor problem.
Got it.
Now, and things that might present more commonly to someone like myself would be a sinonasal tumor, and that's a tumor that would arise in the sinuses. And as you alluded to earlier, Dr. Roscoe, they would have problems with things like nasal blockage, nosebleeds, pain, or if it grows big enough and involves things like the eye socket, they could have double vision or loss of vision in an eye.
So our patients then, when they're coming in, they've known a change in function in this area of their body.
That's right.
So that overall they may go to the emergency room, they may go to their family doctor,
then,
you know, once, say they come in to the family doctor, you know, Garrett, we talk about the four pillars. The four pillars, if you will, you know, the history, the past medical history of the patient. The second pillar is the physical examination. The third pillar is the diagnostic testing. And the fourth pillar is decision-making. So, you know, when the patient would come in, they would give the history. Then we'd want to do an examination, correct?
That's right.
Garrett, they came into your office with symptoms that you've described. Tell my listeners, what would you do with them? How would you examine them? What would be the things you would do in the office? Can you help me with that?
Yes. So typically, if a patient comes to my office with a problem like we're discussing above, let's say, for example, they've been experiencing nasal blockage, some nosebleeds, and for the past month or two, they've had some double vision in one eye. When they came in to see me, I would, of course, get their history. I would, you know, ask them many questions about how long it's gone for, those kind of things. But when it comes to the physical exam, what I would do would be what we call a complete head and neck examination. So I would, of course, look in their ears, their mouth, et cetera. I would feel for lymph nodes in the neck, and I would do what's called a cranial nerve exam. So the cranial nerves are a series of nerves that come out of the brain and through the skull base area and then give a lot of function to the head and neck region. So they would do things like give sensation to the face. They would move the eye sockets in all directions. They would give you vision and associated things. So I would do an examination in the office where I would examine the function of those nerves to determine if any of those have been affected by, you know, whatever process this is.
Yes.
The last thing I would do, and probably the most important thing, is I would do what's called a nasal endoscopy, in which case I would use a small camera to examine inside the nasal and sinus passages to look and see what is going on there from an anatomy standpoint and whether or not there is a growth or a tumor that's present there.
Beautiful. So that overall, we're listening to the patient, we're then examining, we're looking, we have the opportunity to put a camera in these chambers and look for growths. And, you know, once, let's say you find something unusual, what do you do next diagnostically? You know, would you biopsy them in the office, or would you think, you know, I think we need some imaging here? Would that be your next step in your thinking?
That's exactly right. So what I would tell you, Dr. Roscoe, is that for any patient with a suspected growth or mass or tumor, we always obtain imaging. Oftentimes, that starts with a CT scan. And you can think of a CT scan like a stacked series of x-rays that really examines the sinuses, nasal cavity, as well as the bone structure and the associated anatomy around that area. And that gives us a really nice picture of what we're dealing with. In addition, for most of my patients, we also get an MRI scan. And an MRI scan is a little bit of a more involved imaging study, but what it's really good at is looking at the soft tissues in the head and neck region. So it gives us a great indication about the size and dimensions of a tumor, what other structures it may be involving, and it really gives us great information whether or not this tumor is invading surrounding structures like the eye socket, the base of skull, and the eyes, which are really important for us to know about ahead of time. And then as you alluded to earlier, in many cases for tumors, a biopsy is really important. So we oftentimes do complete biopsies in the clinic of nasal tumors, usually under the guidance of the endoscope.
Okay. So that our patients, you know, I'd like to let our listeners know, you know, what to expect from their healthcare professionals. So if they have an issue, they're not surprised by the clinical setting or what the practitioner would like to do. You know, we want to give them information to get rid of the fear of coming in and being looked at.
Right.
Gary, if you were to go ahead, and I know you do this routinely, if indeed you were to do a biopsy, now, would you use some local medication in that process? Was that necessary at all if you're biopsying? You know, is there a protocol that you'd use in doing this?
Yeah, good questions. So in those situations where we do need a biopsy, obviously we try to make the patient who's in front of us, you know, as comfortable as possible. So the first thing I'll do is I'll speak to them just, you know, very clearly and succinctly.
Right.
I'll talk them, you know, through what I'm going to do. And I always say my line is always, there's going to be no surprises for you. So I'm going to talk you through each step of what we're going to do. Now, when it comes to doing a biopsy, obviously we'll talk to them first about what a biopsy entails, what to expect, as well as potential risks. And honestly, for a biopsy in the nose or the sinuses, the main risk we talk about is getting a nosebleed with it, because some of these tumors, Dr. Roscoe, you know, can be quite vascular sometimes.
Yep.
So we talk about, you know, risk of getting a nosebleed or having bleeding afterwards and how we might address or control that. Now, I do typically numb the patient up. In my practice, I usually use topical numbing medication. In some situations, you can certainly inject numbing medication as well. Like many folks may know, as a dentist, they get, sort of a lidocaine injection or a Novocaine injection.
Sure.
Dentist. We do that sometimes as well, but most often it's reasonably comfortable with topical numbing medication, and that's what we use most commonly in my practice.
All right. And so that overall, there may be some discomfort, but indeed there's no surprise, and there's a little bit of a numbing situation going on here.
That's right.
And you're doing the best you can to save them from having to go to the operating room for a biopsy, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Got it. And so we biopsied our patients, and that may take 2 or 3 days, maybe 4 days, to get a report back. So
That's
you
right.
would let the patient go home, and then the pathologist who looks at the tissue would then give you a report and say, hey, we have this kind of a malady. Then what's
right.
your next step?
Yeah, great question. So just in background, what I'll mention to our listeners as we talk about sort of next steps in this process is that tumors in the sinonasal cavity or the sinuses and nasal cavity come in a variety of different types. So there are some areas of the body where if a tumor is there, it's almost assuredly a single entity or a single type of tumor. The difference in the sinonasal cavity is that these tumors that we biopsy can be of a variety of types and etiologies, and they could be a variety of benign or malignant, which is a cancerous pathology. So depending on what the type of tumor is, the treatment options vary quite a bit. Let's say we biopsy it, and it's the most common type of tumor we see in the nose, which is a benign tumor called an inverted papilloma, just for example.
Sure.
That's a case where those ought to be removed because they grow over time and can cause some local tissue destruction in your nose. In addition, if we let them go for a long period of time, a certain percentage can turn or morph into cancer over time. So that's one we definitely recommend surgical removal for. And that, again, that's called an inverted papilloma, which is a fairly common benign tumor of the nose, okay?
Sure.
Now,
and, you know, Garrett,
yeah,
I know there's a plethora if you know, on that tumor
right.
in particular. I know you have others.
Right.
We'll be more than glad to talk about them.
Yes.
But indeed, are there times when you're biopsying that overall the pathology report may come back in and be inconclusive, that they're not able to tell you exactly if it's a benign or a malignant? Do you ever have that situation occur?
Yes, that is a situation that can certainly occur. As our listeners can imagine, When we do a biopsy of a sinus or nasal tumor in the office, the biopsies we obtain tend to be pretty small. So they're not always truly representative of the entire tumor. So there are situations that arise, as Dr. Roscoe mentioned, when it can come back as inconclusive or insufficient tissue to make a full diagnosis. In those situations, we usually recommend that we go to the operating room to have the patient be asleep so they're more comfortable and give us a little bit more control in which situation we can take more tissue and make sure we get a definitive biopsy for the patient.
Beautiful. And so that overall, if more needed to be done, the patient would be comfortable in a setting that they would be asleep. You're able to proceed in a more controlled environment, but getting enough tissue so you're able to help this patient and give them good information about what the problem is, correct?
That is exactly correct. We want them to be comfortable, of course, and also, as you alluded to, a setting where we can obtain enough tissue to get a full diagnosis.
Sure. So I wanted to let our listeners know, Garrett, and that's what our show is about, just kind of giving them the train of events, and especially in something like these head and neck problems. Could I just regress a wee little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And, I know you mentioned the words inverted papilloma.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk to our listeners about a more common tumor, which would be a pituitary tumor, correct?
Absolutely.
As far as, I have an email coming across right now about this, and the listener would like to know that how do you approach pituitary tumors? She had heard they go through her nose to get to the tumor.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I will. That's a very insightful question by one of our listeners in the email there. So I'll give a little bit of background on pituitary tumors. These are probably, in the grand scheme of things, the most common tumor that we operate in the skull base would be a pituitary tumor. Now, as I mentioned earlier in the show, most pituitary tumors originally are referred to a neurosurgeon. And here at UPMC, we have two world-class neurosurgeons who I work with very closely, Dr. Paul Gardner and Dr. George Zanonos, who are, really two of the worldwide experts in endoscopic skull-based surgery, as well as, of course, pituitary surgery.
Sure.
So most commonly, these tumors we would be referred to a neurosurgeon, oftentimes to an endocrinologist as well, because, again, the pituitary gland is an endocrine gland that secretes a variety of hormones. So it is important if someone does have a pituitary tumor to get a thorough endocrine workup to know whether or not the tumor that they have is what we call a functional tumor, in other words, secreting an excess hormone like growth hormone and the acromegaly we talked about earlier, or excess cortisol as in Cushing's disease or those kind of things. Or what's more common is actually what we call a non-functioning pituitary tumor, which is a benign tumor in the pituitary gland but does not secrete any hormones. Instead, it causes problems by pushing on things like the optic nerve for vision loss that we talked about earlier. Now,
I can just elaborate.
Anatomically,
where this pituitary is,
yes,
as it grows, and you've mentioned, this can destroy bone. This can then compress nerves, causing visual problems.
Yes.
So these tumors, even though they're small, can lead to problems, correct?
That's right. And that kind of comes back, Dr. Roscoe, to the fundamental aspect of skull-based surgery, that everything there is high real estate territory. So even small, benign tumors that grow tend to cause problems because they affect the surrounding structures, nerves, arteries, et cetera, around the tumor.
You're absolutely right. As far as if I can ask you, you mentioned the word endoscopic surgeons, talking about these neurosurgeons.
Right.
Would you tell our listeners about what is endoscopic surgery in this setting? Could you help me there?
Yes. So in this setting, endoscopic surgery is what we consider to be a minimally invasive way to approach a variety of tumors in the skull base. Most commonly, we use small endoscopes, typically 4 millimeters in size, as well as specially designed
instruments.
They're tiny. They're small.
Yes.
We work together through the nostrils. So in most cases, We do not need any external incisions on the face or the head. And what we're trying to avoid in many situations is what we call craniotomy. And a craniotomy is a traditional neurosurgical procedure where an incision is made on the scalp or the head and a part of the skull is removed to get the tumors in or around the brain. So the benefit of endoscopic skull-based surgery is that we can do a lot of this work through the nose, not require a craniotomy, and then also, perhaps most importantly, we avoid what's called brain retraction. So during some craniotomies, the brain has to be kind of pushed to the side to access tumors in the bottom of the skull, at the base of the skull. So by
and
working
that's all
the nose,
major surgery, correct?
That's a major surgery. That's right. That's right. And some endoscopic skull-based surgery is also a major surgery, but again, we're saving a lot of the side effects of craniotomy surgery and honestly, brain retraction during the surgery. So
wonderful.
Yeah. And if I could elaborate, Dr. Roscoe, on the question earlier about anatomically kind of where's the pituitary gland and how do we get there, that might dovetail nicely with this discussion. In this situation, the pituitary gland or tumor is in what we call the very back and roof of the sphenoid sinuses. And the sphenoid sinuses are the set of sinuses furthest back in the head. They're almost as deep as where your ear is. If you're going to kind of imagine in the middle of the head, about as deep as the ear, is where the sphenoid sinuses are. So what we do is we do sinus surgery to get there. Then we work together to remove the bone of the sinus overlying the pituitary area, then access that tumor through the roof of the sphenoid sinus. We work together, and the neurosurgeon removes that tumor. Then we put things back together or reconstruct things at the end to re-separate the skull base and brain area from the nose and sinus area.
What I mean, Garrett, what sophisticated surgery, you know? And, Garrett, what about the equipment that you're using?
Yes.
You know, what about, you know, your equipment to visualize, your equipment to remove bone, go ahead and remove tumor?
Yes.
Tell us about the quality of the equipment that you use.
Right. So I will say that when we talk about endoscopic skull-based surgery, you know, it ends up being a pretty specialized surgery, and subsequently we have very specialized equipment. We work with a number of different companies from across the globe who kind of create these instruments for us. The first one, which is really critically important, is our visualization. So you cannot operate well if you can't see what you're doing well. So the endoscopes that we use and the camera systems are really sort of high-end, sophisticated 4K systems, and they've come a long way from when they were first sort of came into vogue in probably the late 80s and early 90s. And the equipment we have currently has, you know, very large screens, very high definition, and honestly, it's almost better than looking with your eyes because it really magnifies things inside the skull base and nose. So, you know, we're looking at these really tiny critical structures. And for us, they're really blown up kind of large on a screen we're looking at.
Magnified.
And we can see that's right, they're magnified. So we see them, you know, really, really well. In addition, we have a lot of different instruments that we use. All of them are specially designed to be long and narrow to use deep inside the sinus cavities in the nose. To remove bone, we use a variety of high-speed drills. So folks in the call probably know dentist drills, right? You got these kind of these drills that spin quickly and remove bone. Somewhat analogously, we use similar drills, but of course they're much longer and higher speed to remove some of that thick bone of the skull base to access these tumors or other critical things in the skull base region. Then, of course, there's a variety of other kind of small, narrow dissection tools, et cetera, we use to isolate and then remove these tumors.
Tremendous, tremendous. And, Garrett, how many people are in the operating room with you when you're doing surgery like this?
Yeah, it ends up being a lot. So just from, you know, sort of the actual surgical aspect, typically there would be someone like myself who is an otolaryngologist who specializes in this kind of skull-based surgery. And then in nearly all these cases, it's one of our neurosurgical partners who's a neurosurgeon who also specializes in skull-based tumor. We also have a circulating nurse in the room, so a nurse who helps to document and get important things and communicate and who's really critically important for these surgeries, as well as a surgical scrub tech, who is someone who as an expert in all the equipment and those kind of things, who is also really, really vital and critical to these cases. And here at UPMC, we have a dedicated group who almost exclusively do skull-based surgery with us, so they're really good at what they do. In addition, we have many... Yeah, of course, yes. So in addition, there are typically an anesthesiologist who oversees the anesthesia and sort of the putting the patient to sleep and those kind of things, keeping them comfortable, as well as often a nurse anesthetist who kind of runs the anesthesia sort of throughout the case for most of the surgery. Also briefly mentioned, Dr. Roscoe, at UPMC, of course, we are a training center. So oftentimes we have trainees who are with us. Those could be fellows or residents who are specialists in their training,
sure.
Surgical trainees. Then oftentimes we have observers. So folks come from across the world and across the country to watch these surgeries and learn about these kind of surgeries. So currently we have folks from China, and we've seen some from Colombia, in Japan, and a variety of countries who are here to learn this surgery well as observers. So we oftentimes have many folks in the operating room with us who are also learning.
Yeah, I mean, that was my point. There are a lot of people there that are working, functioning, observing, doing these surgeries, you know, letting our listeners know that they're asleep, but there's an awful lot of people there, you know, wanting them to do extremely well.
That's right.
Garrett, you know, we've already done 30 minutes here. The lines for questions are full.
Okay.
Would you mind taking a couple of questions? Mr. Mancini is running the questions in the studio in L.A.
Yes.
How about if he starts to bring some questions to us? And if you wouldn't mind answering, I would appreciate it. So, Mr. Mancini, can we take some live questions?
Yes, and boy, what a great interview you guys got going. So I'll keep it short. I'll bring a few of them to the forefront. Darren, coming in from Milford, Connecticut, says, what are the symptoms of a skull-based tumor?
That's a very insightful question. So as I alluded to earlier, there are a variety of symptoms that can occur. And really, it depends on the anatomic location of the tumor. So, for instance, the most common things that we see from a sinus or a nasal tumor are things like nasal obstruction or nosebleeds, or when they become more advanced, they affect some of those nerves. So things like invasion of the eye socket or the nerves of the eye can cause double vision or vision change, or sometimes numbness of the cheek or of the palate, the hard palate, as those nerves can become involved sometimes. Now, tumors in other regions like the pituitary area or above there, an area called the planum or the tuberculum, which is just above the pituitary gland, oftentimes cause vision change or loss because they push on those optic nerves or those vision nerves early on and can cause double vision or vision loss. So those are some of the things that we see from a symptom standpoint for tumors in the skull base.
Great. Again, very good. Great.
Let me bring in Doug from Corpus Texas. He says, how long can you live with a tumor in the skull? That's an excellent question.
Yeah, I agree. And the good news the good news is for a lot of these tumors, they are benign, which means a non-cancerous tumor. So in many of these, if we can remove them, life expectancy is unchanged. So that's great in many of those scenarios. Now, on the flip side, there also can be cancers in this region. There can be sinus or nasal cancers. The most common ones that I treat would be things like, I would tell you the names of them, esthesioneuroblastoma, squamous cell carcinoma, or some melanomas also occur in the nose and sinuses. And those ones, again, if we can remove them, they have a good clinical response, then typically they can live for quite a long time and hopefully a typical normal lifespan. Some of them, if they're advanced or spread, of course, can affect life expectancy. But I will tell you that those are the minority of sinus and nasal tumors, not the majority.
Excellent.
Well, let me take more. I'll give it back to you guys, and I'll see you guys in about 25 minutes pretty much. Tim coming in from Escondido says, what's the success rate of these surgeries?
Great question, Tim. So I would tell you that the majority of patients that we operate on as far as success rate goes, and success can be measured in a variety of different ways, but every surgery that we have has a certain goal associated with it. If our goal is total removal of a tumor, we call that a total resection, if you will. And depending on the location of the tumor, we oftentimes have very good success with that. Now, there are some tumors that are not totally removable surgery because they are encasing a critical structure. I'll give you an example. Some tumors have grown large enough that they completely surround the carotid artery. In those cases, the tumor itself may not be totally removable, but our goal in surgery is to remove enough that the symptoms it's causing get better or go away. And again, in most of situations, we are able to accomplish the goals of the surgery.
Wow.
Wow.
And so you do have certain outcomes that you look at once you understand the pathology, you understand where the tumor is. And, Garrett, now you would talk to the patient about this preoperatively, correct, informing them about what you can and can't do?
That's exactly right. So we always meet with the patients before surgery, again, both the neurosurgeon and myself, and we have a very thorough and detailed discussion about what the type of tumor is, what its location is, what treatment options are available, and if surgery is the best treatment option, we talk about exactly what the goals of surgery will be and what is accomplishable through that approach.
Excellent.
Wow. Can I take one more? Let me take one more, and I'll give it back to you because this one guy was pushing it. He's a regular to the show, Steve from Corvallis. Doc, he said, what's the difference between what you do, Garrett, being a skull-based surgeon and a neurologist? Does it work hand in hand, or is there a difference between the two? That's another excellent question.
Right, right. So a neurologist is a physician who specializes in, of course, diseases of the nervous system, and a neurologist is one of our medical doctors. So a neurologist is critically important. They do tremendous work, but they do not do surgery. So they see folks in the office and they do procedures and those kind of things. But when it comes to a surgery, that would be a neurosurgeon who would take over the care of that patient for the surgical issue, and a neurologist would treat things with medical therapy and other procedures, but not doing a surgery themselves.
Okay.
I think that's an excellent explanation of the different specialties.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, do you have one more, or you want me to go back to our discussion?
I can take one more if you want. It's Dalen from Chelmsford, Mass., and basically he says, what is the specialty for skull-based surgery? Is there a specialty for it?
Right. So really, for these skull-based tumors or skull-based surgeries, there's typically two surgeons working together, and one of them is a neurosurgeon who has subspecialty training in skull-based surgery. And the second one is typically an otolaryngologist or an ear, nose, and throat surgeon who also has subspecialty training in skull-based surgery. So typically these kind of cases are worked on together as a team, and both the neurosurgeon and the otolaryngologist both have subspecialty training in this particular discipline.
So they're very highly specialized. And, Garrett, now you're not doing tonsillectomies or putting tubes in or doing mastoidectomies, your specialty is working in the sinuses, correct? You're not doing cosmetic surgery or septoplasty, correct?
That's right. So at these kind of centers, I don't see any patients for ear problems or throat problems or neck problems or other things. I really just focus it on the sinuses and skull base and in the surgical management of those diseases. So it's a pretty narrow band specialty. But again, for what we do, it's really important that you have a very narrow practice so you can really develop expertise in what you do. And I will just mention, one of the things I love about what I do is getting to work with another surgeon as a team every day. So I really enjoy working together with another surgeon, and team-based surgery is sort of what my passion is. So that's really one of the best parts of my job. And, sort of having that as the exclusive practice of what you do is really nice.
Excellent. Thank you, Mark, for the questions. And, Garrett, we have many more. There just isn't time to answer all the questions. But thank you for doing that.
Yes.
Garrett, I'd like to get back to our discussion. You know, we talked about the operating room, all these people. We have a neurosurgeon. We have an otolaryngologist specializing in skull-based surgery. You know, the concept that come up also, and I think you probably do it as well, is having a reconstruction team also, correct? That if you're taking tumors out, you may have another team to go in and reconstruct the operated area. Is
right.
that how you do things there in Pittsburgh?
Right, right. So that is a very insightful question. So what I would tell you, Dr. Roscoe, is a lot
yeah.
of the surgery we do that are purely through the nose or sinuses, we will, the neurosurgeon myself will reconstruct that together. We use a lot of different
okay.
Flaps of tissue inside the nose and can sort of swing those over and cover those things up and reconstruct that. Now, on the other hand, I think what you're alluding to is some of our amazing head and neck oncology and reconstructive surgery partners. And they are really critical, not only in their area where they're doing things like, you know, removing part of the jaw for cancer and those kind of things.
Surely.
But also in many areas of the skull base, tagging them in to help with the reconstruction. And we have a tremendous group here who are really worldwide experts in reconstructive surgery, especially in what's termed free flap reconstruction. And this is not the majority of cases we do, but certainly in many situations we need them. And what that refers to, Dr. Roscoe, is when there's not
yeah.
much left in the region we're working in, and they borrow tissue from elsewhere, oftentimes from the leg or a bone from the leg, and they bring it up to the area we're working in, and they plug it
wow.
back to the blood vessels in kind of the head and neck region and then
wow.
put that back together. And, oh, my goodness, they are amazing. They
wow.
do amazing work in reconstruction.
Wow. How sophisticated. And
oh my goodness,
that work
yes.
is being done, yeah, at
right.
University of Pittsburgh now, I guess, correct? You're doing that.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, I think we have a lot of great momentum there, and we brought in a recent addition who's our head and neck division chief, who is just a world-class reconstructive surgeon. And I think just last week, that group together, I think, did 11 free flap reconstructions. So really
wow.
just referrals coming
wow.
all over the place, and they are cruising. They're doing a really, really amazing work.
Fantastic. You
yes.
know, what great people to have
mm-hmm.
when you need something like this.
That's
and,
right.
You
That's
know,
right.
Garrett, again, thank you for answering that question. You know, if we're going on here, you know, we had touched a little bit about pituitary tumors, and then you mentioned the word inverted papilloma.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other buzzwords here, cancer-wise,
right.
that maybe our listeners may hear? What
right.
are the other, you know, briefly now,
yes.
what are the other tumors that you work with overall? I know you mentioned esthesioblastoma.
Right.
Talk a little bit about the cadre that can occur
right.
in this area, please. Thank
right.
you.
Absolutely. So I'll kind of touch on a few of them. I'll try to be fairly succinct as I sort of discuss them.
Surely, no problem.
Yeah, one that I mentioned earlier that a cancerous tumor that we deal with is called an esthesioneuroblastoma, or an alternative name is an olfactory neuroblastoma. That's
wow.
a cancer that arises from actually the smell nerves in the roof of the nose. And the challenge with that tumor is that it spreads to the intracranial or the brain space very quickly because, again, it sort of arises in the very roof of the sinuses. Now, that
sure.
is a tumor that we can usually resect endoscopically through the nose in most situations. That's one that we deal with quite a bit. The most common
–
yeah, go ahead, Dr. Roscoe.
Yeah, just on that one. I mean, that's a real fancy name.
Right.
How does
right.
one know? How would our listeners know that they may have something that serious, if you will? Can you elaborate
right.
on that tumor just a little bit?
Sure, sure. So the symptoms of that tumor in some ways are common to all tumors in the nose. And again, those are things like nasal blockage, nose bleeds, and those kind
sure.
of things. But in particular, this tumor, one of the early signs may be smell loss. Because, again, it's growing amongst the smell nerves in the roof of the nose. So smell loss can be a symptom of that kind of tumor as well. Now, of course, most loss sense of smell is due to other routine things. People have heard about
surely.
You know, COVID-related
yep.
smell loss or
absolutely.
You know, chronic sinusitis or those kind of things. But certainly if you've got you know bad nasal obstruction and nosebleeds and loose sense of smell, that's one thing that we're thinking about for something like an esthesioneuroblastoma.
Wow. And you know, if we would, again, just if we go ahead and, you know, someone comes in, again, with maybe some multiple symptoms, talking about they can't smell, you're going to look, and then you're going to go in through your process, correct, of
trying
to diagnose, correct, and then giving them the answer here, which, MRs, CTs. Go ahead.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, Dr. Roscoe, that most patients, by the time they see me, have already gotten most of their imaging done. So at this point in time, you know, it's relatively easy to order imaging, and we kind of know when they come in to see me exactly what we're dealing with in many situations.
So that you have an idea to go ahead and counsel your patient and then start thinking about what's our best treatment here, correct?
That's exactly right. And I'll give you just an example of what, you know, may frequently happen is someone presents locally, their physician, they get a workup, and maybe a scan is obtained, and it looks like there is a mass or tumor in the sinuses. And sometimes we actually see that patient on telemedicine. So they send their images in.
Wow.
We visit with them, you know, on telemedicine. And then if they have a diagnosis and a biopsy ready, then we know exactly what to do. Sometimes they haven't. We bring them in to do that biopsy, those kind of things. But, again, imaging has made stuff really accessible for us because, again, a picture is worth 1,000 words. So we can really sort of see those images and know exactly what we're dealing with ahead of time.
You know, one tumor that I think that I'm a little bit aware of is a craniopharyngioma.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that tumor?
Yeah, absolutely. So a cranial, right.
Yeah.
So a craniopharyngioma is a relatively rare tumor. It can occur in both children and adults. It is also a benign tumor, so not a cancerous growth, but it grows in an area that we refer to as the supracellar space, which means above the cella or above the pituitary gland. And usually this kind of tumor is intimately associated with the stalk of the pituitary gland, and it typically causes symptoms because it's growth. So it can cause headaches as it grows. It can also cause vision loss or vision change, as we talked about earlier. And in some situations, it can actually cause pituitary hormonal shifts as it may push on the pituitary gland.
Wow. And, again, you could detect that, you know, from the imaging coming in. You would be able to say, hey, location-wise, this is what it looks like. Now, you may not be able to biopsy that in the office, though.
That's right, because that kind of tumor is what we call an intracranial tumor. So it's actually at the very base of the brain above the skull base. So those are typically diagnosed based on their characteristic imaging features, but we do not biopsy them until we actually remove them with surgery. So that's the one that we trust our imaging to give us the diagnosis based on very characteristic features. And then when it comes out, of course, it gets diagnosed in the pathology lab with surgery, but it's typically not biopsied ahead of time. That's right.
And, you know, Garrett, is there a different approach to something like that as opposed to a pituitary tumor? Or could you go, you know, through the nose to approach that? Is that one of those kind of tumors?
Right. So I would say for craniopharyngiomas in, you know, 90 to 95% of cases, we still go through the nose and we approach a tumor that way. In layman's terms, the approach is quite similar to a pituitary tumor approach. The difference is we've got to go in front of and above the pituitary gland. So for us, it's a little bit different of an angle and approach to work really on the intracranial space as opposed to the pituitary gland.
Got it. If you could save the patient from having a craniotomy order to approach it, correct?
That's right. In the vast majority of cases, we can. That's exactly right.
Wonderful. You know, I mean, thank you for that. And, you know, you're doing all this sophisticated surgery, all these very sophisticated organs, all these nerves and blood vessels. Would you mind talking a little bit about, I know you're an excellent surgeon, are there complications that can occur with different leakage, et cetera? You want to talk a little bit about what can happen, even in the best hands?
Right. Yes, that's a great question. And as the listeners can probably imagine, anytime we do any surgery, there's a risk of complications or trouble afterwards. And, of course, skull-based surgery, when you work in these really critical areas, certainly complications and problems are at the forefront of our mind. The most common and unique thing that we see in endoscopic skull-based surgery is a risk of what's called a CSF or cerebrospinal fluid leak. And what that really refers to is around the brain cavity, our brain is encased by, we call it spinal fluid or cerebrospinal fluid. CSF is the acronym given to that. And when we're doing a lot of these tumors, especially the intracranial tumors, as the listeners can imagine, we are creating a communication, a hole between the sinuses and the brain. So we're creating this this corridor, which of course we're going to have a leakage of that fluid during that. Now, when we're done with surgery, we need to reconstruct or fix that hole, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But if we don't, the patient is at risk for infection and meningitis because there would be a communication from the sinuses and nose into the brain cavity. Now, in the early days of endoscopic skull-based surgery, CSF leaks afterwards were a huge problem. They were very common, and a lot of issues were caused by these after-surgery or post-surgery CSF leaks. Now, in around 2006-2007, there was a new reconstructive technique that was developed, largely out of the folks here at University of Pittsburgh where most of endoscopic skull-based surgery was developed. And it was a reconstructive flap in the tissue, a reconstructive tissue flap in the nose based on an artery in the back of the nose. We call that the nasoseptal flap. And with the development of the nasoseptal flap, the ability for us to fix or reconstruct these holes or defects in the skull base was tremendously improved. And that development really has allowed us to take on larger and more complex intracranial tumors while having very good success rates with fixing CSF leaks at the end of the surgery.
And, you know, Garrett, are you aware at the time of surgery that there is a CSF leak? Is it something you prepare to fix, or do you wait to see if they have one?
Right.
How do you
right.
handle that situation?
Yeah, so in all these cases, throughout the surgery, we are very, very closely looking for a CSF leak. Of course, in many of the ones that we do, it's very obvious because we're creating these large corridors into the brain space. But there are ones, Dr. Roscoe, where it's a smaller tumor, it's much more subtle. So we are looking for that throughout the case. And in the vast majority of cases, if there is a CSF leak, we see it during surgery and we repair it at the end of surgery. There are situations where it's conceivable that it wouldn't occur until afterwards, but those are very rare and few and far between. The vast majority, we see them in surgery and we repair them at the end of the surgery.
Wonderful. So that overall, part of your surgical plan is to be prepared that you've taken, that you've accessed the tumor, you've taken the tumor out, then you've gone ahead and you thought about a reconstructive plan to close that area, and then with your flap or whatever it may be, to go ahead and seal the area. And if we use the word CSF, can you tell our listeners about cerebrospinal fluid? Where is it?
Yeah, great point. And, you know, when you think about just briefly about reconstruction, you mentioned earlier, I think we think about during the case and before the case. And I was always taught growing up that the five P's, prior preparation prevents poor performance. So we are always thinking about reconstructive options 1, 2, and 3 before we ever start the case. That's a really important point. Now, cerebrospinal fluid is a fluid that surrounds both the spinal cord and the brain, and that kind of circulates throughout your body throughout the day, and that's actually turned over multiple times throughout the day. So it's made and created and resorbed in the body. It's, again, the whole volume is overturned multiple times per day. So that's just a fluid that kind of insulates and protects things. When someone who, let's say, needs some testing done for a neurologic condition that gets a lumbar puncture, a small needle in the back, they actually draw out and test some of that fluid. That same fluid in the spine is in communication to the fluid around the brain cavity. And again, it's made in that area and resorbed and turned over multiple times per day.
Yeah, it's a very important fluid organ in our body's health, correct?
That's right. That's absolutely correct.
Gary, you know, they talk about if you have, say you've done surgery, What about putting some kind of a drain in to help diminish the CSF? Is that old thinking, or is there something you do along those lines to maybe decrease the CSF pressure? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Right, absolutely. So what you're referring to is called a lumbar drain, and in some cases that's where we put a small catheter through the back that drains off some of that spinal fluid to divert the pressure because the whole spinal fluid and CSF is under pressure. So when we repair a skull-based defect, in some cases, we want to sort of divert or take that pressure off by putting in a lumbar puncture and diverting some fluid away. Now, Dr. Roscoe, in in the past 20 to 30 years, lumbar drains were used very, very commonly in most of these cases. In our current situation, we actually use lumbar drains very rarely in the skull-based surgeries that we do, probably about 5% or less of cases. And those are really in select situations that have a very high risk of a CSF leak after surgery. And that's most commonly what we refer to as the posterior cranial fossa, and that's the area of the brainstem. Now, us, the most common tumor that we would address in that area would be called a clival chordoma, which when we remove those, we know that there's a higher rate of spinal fluid leak, and it's a higher pressure area. When we remove tumors there and reconstruct it, we generally put a lumbar drain in those cases, but it's pretty rare outside of those particular areas.
Oh, very good. You know, I just had an email when I asked the question about a patient that did have a drain for that. Very interesting. Garrett, the hour is over.
That went by quickly.
My God, it went very quickly. Would you mind summarizing a little bit of our discussion about skull-based surgery and what you do and, you know, overall the results that you've gotten?
Yes, absolutely. So I would say, you know, Dr. Roscoe, in summary, I am trained as an otolaryngologist who's an ear, nose, and throat and head and neck surgeon, and my subspecialty training is doing skull-based and endoscopic skull-based surgery. Most of my surgeries happen with a team, and I work very closely with my neurosurgeons here, two partners in particular, Dr. Paul Gardner and Dr. George Zanonos, who are really world-class neurosurgeons. And I have two partners here in my specialty, Dr. Carl Snyderman, Dr. Eric Wong, who are internationally renowned otolaryngologists and skull-based surgeons who we work really closely as a team together.
Yes.
I'm
just mentioning you have a first-class team
to
handle almost all these problems. There's probably very few that you can't handle, correct?
That's right. So we see folks from across the country and across the world who are referred in for these kind of tumors and for these kind of surgeries. And every tumor and every patient presents unique challenges, but in the vast majority, we were able to help them significantly. And whether it's an endoscopic approach or in some cases an open approach, for that tumor and for that patient, we do what we think the best is for them. And, of course, it's a shared decision-making model where we discuss these things and we come to a conclusion together about the best course of action.
Excellent. Mr. Mancini, I think the hour is over. Do you want to help close the show?
Yeah, let everybody know, Garrett, how everybody can get a hold of you if they have any questions or stuff. But this show was absolutely terrific. We need to bring you back again.
Very good. I'd be happy to anytime. Let me know. That does have a skull-based tumor or a sinus or nasal tumor or cancer that wishes to have an opinion, the easiest way to get a hold of us is our office scheduling phone number is area code 412-647-2100. That's probably the best way to get scheduled.
Excellent.
Okay.
And, Garrett, thank you, and I would love to have you back on.
Anytime.
I talk about next week, Mr. Mancini?
Yes. Yep.
Let our listeners know, and again, next week, that we're having Kip Gross, a former major league ball player pitcher. We're having Dr. Matt Barrichello, sports medicine, talking about the major league season, talking about elbow injuries, rehab of elbow injuries, Tommy John surgery. We're looking at this now. how can we prevent this in these athletes? And we know that, that Kip has a program that he helps train major leaguers to prevent. We have Dr. Varicello that does repairs. So it should be a very interesting show starting baseball season. So I want to thank Dr. Garrett Chobe. You were outstanding. Thank you for an excellent hour. And if people want to get a hold of me, GJRMD308@outlook.com. Go ahead, Mr. Mancini.
Okay, they've already given the info. You can catch this show on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast Platforms and across the social media platforms. Till next week, for the guys in Pittsburgh, yours truly, Mark Mancini, signing off in Los Angeles. Thanks for tuning in and making us part of your afternoon drive in both cities. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.